a course about writing or being in a workshop. I didn't know any other writers. And of course, it was the time of the boom of Latin American literature, and they were all male. They were all men. And it was happening in the periphery of my life. I was reading their work, but I could never even dream of getting in touch with any of them.
The world-renowned writer Isabel Allende, her latest novel, The Wind Knows My Name. She's the author of 26 books that have sold more than 77 million copies and translated into more than 40 languages. She just recently turned 80 years old. To see all our interviews with Isabel Allende, visit democracynow.org. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
So, how much is that golden doodle or adorable Frenchie in the window? Probably a lot, especially in terms of suffering for its parents, who in many cases are living lives of misery in a puppy mill. On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll be talking with Robert Hensley, senior counsel for the ASPCA, about their push to pass Goldie's Act, a bill now in Congress that would ensure better conditions and oversight for the hundreds of thousands of dogs now suffering at the hands of large-scale dog breeders.
The dog that Goldie's Act is named for was one of the dogs that lived in squalor and tragically was allowed to starved to death over several months while USDA inspectors observed her deteriorating condition, but did nothing to help her.
That's on the next Voices for the Animals, Friday, July 28th at 10 a.m. on 90.7 KBOO FM. If you love animals, and especially dogs, don't miss it. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. Up next, we have the evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Kmart fire in Northeast Portland spews asbestos-laden ash over nearby neighborhoods.
Proud Boy Tusitala Tiny Toisi is sentenced to 8 years for brawling at that very same Kmart.
And local UPS workers rally ahead of a potential strike.
News for Friday, July 21st, 2023. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Josh Salem. Ash and debris from the Kmart fire in the Portland Park Rose neighborhood may contain asbestos. That's according to the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. The fire burned earlier this week, and charred pieces of the abandoned building and heavy dust were found around the neighborhood. The DEQ released guidelines for residents, asking people to avoid touching debris and stop yard work for the time being. That includes sweeping up debris that's covering their yards. Moving it around can kick up the asbestos and result in people inhaling the harmful chemical. Asbestos is a naturally occurring mineral that was used in construction for many years because it is resistant to fire. Its use was mostly discontinued because long-term exposure causes lung cancer and mesothelioma. Activities at Lewitt Park were canceled for today, and summer school students at the Park Rose schools across the street were required to stay inside. Residents in the Park Rose and Argate Terrace neighborhoods already face some of the worst air quality in the state, and they say they weren't given adequate guidance after the fire. Oregon DEQ spokesperson Susan Mills told KGW, quote, "We don't know for sure everything has asbestos, and so we want to be clear about that. But for now, we want people to be cautious, and in case it might be asbestos, you don't want to move it, because asbestos is microfibers. Even if they're chunks, when they break, there are microfibers, and those microfibers could be inhaled and could cause respiratory problems," end quote. The DEQ says they'll have a link on their website homepage with more information by the end of the day.
Notorious Proud Boy Tusitala Toisi, known as Tiny, has been sentenced to 8 years in prison for violence at Portland rallies. In March, a Multnomah County judge found Toisi guilty of 5 counts of assault, 2 counts of unlawful use of a weapon, 2 riot counts, and 2 counts of criminal mischief. Those charges stemmed from a far-right political rally held in the parking lot of a former Kmart. Toisi was an MC and organizer of the event in 2021. It resulted in clashes between far-right protesters and anti-fascist protesters. In particular, Toisi directed far-right protesters to physically attack the driver of a pickup truck because he believed they were an anti-fascist protester. It is not the first time Toisi has faced similar charges, dating back to 2017. Back then, he punched a counter-protester in the face, unprovoked, and pled guilty to a harassment charge. He was also charged with assault in 2018, but fled to American Samoa. When he returned to Portland, he was put on probation, but has failed to comply.
Over 340,000 UPS workers across the United States could go on strike August 1st. The Teamsters are fighting for better pay and better treatment on the job. UPS has agreed to put AC in delivery trucks, but the sides are at odds on pay and benefits for part-time workers. They make up more than half of the UPS workforce. If the employees go on strike, it would be the largest work stoppage in half a century, and it could mean big impact on the package delivery system. Each day, UPS delivers 6% of the gross domestic product. Locally, several dozen part-time UPS workers rallied outside the UPS Swan Island hub today. Brian Dennings is a part-time UPS employee. Here's part of what Dennings told the crowd this morning.
I'm a part-timer. I started here about a year ago. I meet a lot of people inside who work on preload who've been here for 10, 15, 20 years in some cases. There's one guy on my shift who was here for the last strike in 1997. And the main thing I see from people is we all want a living wage. We want to be recognized for the work we do. We want to be able to afford to live in the city that we live in, right?
Yeah.
No one I know can afford their rent. I know people who work inside who are on food stamps.
That was Brian Dennings. Workers were joined by local politicians and community supporters. Two dozen locally elected officials have signed on to a UPS Teamster Solidarity letter. The last time UPS workers went on strike was in 1997. The 15-day strike resulted in major wins for the unionized workers, like increasing the starting pay for part-time workers for the first time in over a decade and turning 10,000 part-time jobs into full-time positions.
Next summer, Portland will stop funding the Regional Arts and Culture Council. Earlier this afternoon, Commissioner Dan Ryan met with the Regional Arts and Culture Council to deliver the news that the city would allow its contract with the independent arts body to expire. The council provides grants to local groups that provide arts education, events, and advocacy. The council is funded by Portland, as well as Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties, and the regional government, Metro. Most of the budget, however, 83%, is paid by Portland and its $35 arts tax. The news doesn't come as a huge shock. Members of the Arts Council say they've suspected the city would pull support in the previous months. Last November, Portland Commissioners Joanne Hardesty and Mingus Mapps rejected the Arts and Culture Council's annual report, saying there wasn't adequate reporting about the outcomes of the money spent. Instead, Portland plans to form its own city office of arts and culture to do essentially the same thing the Regional Arts and Culture Council does now. Commissioner Ryan clarified that no grantees funded by the Arts Council this fiscal year will be affected.
Owners of a dairy farm in southern Oregon, previously fined by the state for letting cow manure flow into the Applegate River, have now pled guilty to federal charges. Noble Family Dairy is located about 13 miles southeast of Grants Pass. They dumped the manure into the river for at least 20 days in 2019, incurring state charges and a civil penalty in 2020. The dairy also had more cows than were allowed under its confined animal feeding operation permit. This week, the owners of the dairy, Sharon and Larry Noble, pleaded guilty in U.S. District Court in Medford to violating their waste discharge permit from the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. That's a misdemeanor under the Federal Clean Water Act. The agency ordered the operation to pay an approximately $25,000 fine to the U.S. government, a small fraction of the essentially $500,000 they could have been penalized. According to court records, the illegal disposal of manure into the Applegate River caused significantly higher levels of E. coli bacteria for months. Testing in late March 2019 revealed the water downstream of the dairy had more than 1,500 times the acceptable level of E. coli under state water quality standards. When ingested, E. coli bacteria can cause severe intestinal and urinary tract problems, pneumonia, meningitis, kidney failure, and death. Several bills in the recent legislative session targeted confined animal feeding permits, calling for stricter regulations on their land and water use. Senate Bill 85, which passed on partisan lines, required operations that wished to expand to be inspected first by the state agriculture department. It also set restrictions on the use of groundwater. The bill is awaiting Governor Kotek's signature.
The city of Sandy, Oregon, is on the hook for $500,000 in penalties for polluting nearby waterways. That's the result of a settlement with the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. KBOO's Grant Button has more.
The city of Sandy must pay $500,000 to state and federal agencies in order to settle multiple Clean Water Act violations dating back to 2017. This includes payments to the U.S. Treasury and Oregon government. This is because over the past 6 years, the city's wastewater facility has consistently released more pollutants than environmental permits allow. The facility contaminated Tickle Creek as well as the Clackamas River with high volumes of waste. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, the settlement requires the city to make certain improvements to its wastewater facility by October of 2023 in order to improve the reliability and capacity of the facility. They are also required to give updated progress reports every 6 months. Sandy leaders have also agreed to limit the number of new businesses that can be hooked up to their sewer system. They noted that the old treatment plan did not keep up well with the rapid population growth and that they plan to spend $133 million improving the city system over the next few years. The city's penalty could be reduced to $50,000 if significant improvements are made by 2028. For KBOO News, I'm Grant Button.
The Ninth Circuit Court rejects efforts by tribes to block the Thacker Pass lithium mine along the Oregon-Nevada border. And tribal advocates and conservationists say the mine violates environmental laws and would destroy sacred lands. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Tribal leaders and conservationists working to block construction of a lithium mine along the Nevada-Oregon line lost the fight in court this week when a three-judge panel at the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals rejected their arguments to overturn federal approval of the project. Christina Onnested has more.
The judges rejected claims that permitting the Thacker Pass mine violates environmental laws and would destroy sacred lands to the Paiute, Shoshone, and Washoe people, whose ancestors were massacred there more than 150 years ago in 1865. Max Wilbert, co-founder of Protect Thacker Pass, says they will continue fighting.
Under American law, mining is the highest and best use of public lands. It's more important than sacred sites. It's more important than wildlife. It's more important than water. I think we're going to need to step this up in all kinds of different ways.
They could appeal the decision. A second separate lawsuit is also challenging the lithium mine. The conflict has pitted environmentalists and Native Americans against President Joe Biden's plans to combat climate change and reduce reliance on fossil fuels, since the lithium mine would produce a key mineral used in green technology, like electric cars. Again, Wilbert.
We all wish that the transition away from fossil fuels could bring us into some utopian future right away. But we have to recognize that whether you're producing an electric car or a fossil fuel powered car, there are raw materials, there's extraction involved in that, there's pollution. And unless we can reduce driving, reduce the consumption of cars, reduce how much energy we need and so on, then we're really just going to be tinkering around the edges.
Christina Onnested, National Native News.
On Thursday, we brought you the voices of Crow Nation teachers in South Central Montana collaborating on Crow language lesson materials. Today, we have more on the resources those educators are helping to create. Among existing Crow language materials are children's books, a dictionary, and a digital database of words, with more planned. Yellowstone Public Radio's Kayla DeRoche reports.
You click on it.
This app, Crow Language Instructor Vance Crooked Arm pulls up on his phone, features more than 10,000 words and audio recordings.
So if you say young,
Hiraka.
See, it says the word for you.
This is one of the products created by the Crow Language Consortium, a network of schools, colleges, and educators committed to preserving Crow or Abzalika. Crow tribal member Janine Pease sits on the consortium board. She says more than a decade ago, the Crow Nation found fewer than 15% of preschoolers spoke fluent Abzaliga.
And it was extremely alarming.
They've been working to reverse that trend. For the past 8 years, Pease says, young Crow Nation students have taken language immersion classes as part of a still-evolving program to increase Abzaliga fluency.
The schools will progress through our materials, and we're very anxious to have all the building blocks that children can use to acquire vocabulary and to construct conversations.
She says ongoing written projects geared towards students in kindergarten through fourth grade include reading materials on Crow Nation leaders and major moments in Crow history. A dictionary for children is also due for publication in the fall.
That was Kayla DeRoche reporting. The Native American Basketball Invitational is celebrating 20 years at this year's tournament, which kicked off this week in Phoenix, Arizona. 144 teams are taking part in the tournament. Boys and girls, ages 14 to 19, representing more than 120 tribal communities from across North America, are competing. The event also features an educational summit and a college and career fair. Championship games will take place on Sunday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be sunny and clear with an overnight low of 60 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be hot and sunny with a high of 87. Today in history, in 1983, the world's lowest temperature in an inhabited location was recorded at Vostok Station in Antarctica at negative 128 degrees Fahrenheit. The quote of the day is from American actor and comedian Robin Williams, who was born this day in 1951. He said, quote, "I'm a very tolerant man, except when it comes to holding a grudge."
Trees are a fundamental part of keeping us cool in the summer, since they lower air temperatures and humidity. However, trees can experience heat stresses themselves, leading to declines in their health. KBOO's Grant Button spoke with arborist Michael Spaulding to learn more about how to help trees beat the heat.
As global temperatures continue to rise, our plant life, including trees, are continually met with heat stresses. In order to learn more about how to help trees beat the heat, I spoke with Michael Spaulding, an arborist for the Davy Tree Company. He says there are many visual effects of heat stress on Oregon's native plantscape.
We're seeing a lot of our native plantscape starting to have some sparse canopies that can be off-colored. The leaves can be a little scorched, see a little bit more yellowing in the trees. We'll find wilted or drooping or curling leaves that turn brown and the tips can be burnt back. Sometimes we see premature fall colors, so you'll see fall colors coming in earlier as a result of the stress.
In order to prepare for warm summers and prevent trees from getting heat stress, he explains there's benefit to using mulch, specifically in the fall.
In the fall, get a couple bags of either steer manure or chicken manure, some good composted soil, and spread that around the base of any of your trees in the drip zone that you may want to boost for health. It's a solid fertilizer. And allow the rain season to rain that into the soil profile. You know, as we have more of a rainy season, as we get into October, November, December, the soil loosens up and it'll put those nutrients deep into the soil and they'll be there for next spring's pop. If you do this annually, you will have an amazing turnaround.
During the summer, Spaulding recommends watering early in the morning or overnight so that the daytime heat does not evaporate the water before the tree can absorb it. He also says it's important where the tree is watered.
You want to avoid watering around the trunk of the tree, like right on the trunk of the tree. This increased moisture, it can cause root rot and some decay in some spaces, and you want to concentrate in the area directly beneath the foliage around the drip zone.
Spaulding cautions against overwatering, recommending running a sprinkler or drip hose beneath the tree only once or twice a week. Trees play a large role in cooling down neighborhoods and breaking up urban heat islands, which can cool the city down by up to 10 degrees, cutting air conditioning needs by up to 50%. Maintaining healthy trees in the summer is increasingly more important as climate change worsens, and using these strategies can help them thrive in the heat. For KBOO News, I'm Grant Bunn.
The U.S. Senate mulls Supreme Court ethics, while the House Speaker reportedly promised to expunge former President Trump's impeachments. And Florida's Board of Education passes controversial African-American history standards. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I can't help but believe that this is just another episode in a long-standing campaign of intimidation and a harassment of the Supreme Court and its members.
Republican Texas Senator John Cornyn opposes Democrats pushing for a more stringent ethics code for Supreme Court justices. It's become a hot-button issue following revelations of travel by Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito and Justice Sonia Sotomayor's book sales. The Senate Judiciary Committee advanced a bill along party lines. Senate Judiciary Chair Dick Durbin said it's a first step to restore confidence in the court.
Historians and legal scholars from across the political spectrum agree that legislation imposing a code of conduct on the Supreme Court is both necessary and well within Congress's congressional authority.
The measure now heads to the Senate floor. Democratic presidential hopeful Robert F. Kennedy Jr. spoke before Congress Thursday and denied making racist or anti-Semitic comments, despite a video in which he claimed the COVID-19 virus was targeted to attack Caucasians and blacks disproportionately, while Ashkenazi Jews and Chinese individuals were more immune.
In my entire life, I have never uttered a phrase that was either racist or anti-Semitic.
President Joe Biden used video clips of Republican Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, who compared him to Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon B. Johnson, to promote his campaign online. Biden, who was in Philadelphia Thursday to promote clean energy jobs, cracked a joke about Greene.
Said Biden is doing things like Roosevelt and it goes on the line as if it's creating these jobs, and he thinks that. I never had an endorsement from him before.
As former President Donald Trump's legal woes deepen, House Speaker Kevin McCarthy has reportedly promised to expunge former President Donald Trump's impeachments in exchange for not endorsing his campaign, according to Politico. Sources told the publication a vote could come before the August recess. The speaker has reportedly denied making such a promise. Finally, education officials in Florida have approved new standards to teach students about African American history. Other lessons will touch on acts of violence perpetrated against and by African Americans. Florida Commissioner of Education Manny Diaz pushed back against claims the new standards censor history.
And if anyone takes the time to actually look at the standards, you can see that everything is covered from elementary school, where we start talking about those who have been prominent African Americans, and as age appropriate, we go into some of the tougher subjects.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our ATRUST indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The safety of the artificial sweetener aspartame has been called into question in recent days by the World Health Organization. However, not everyone agrees, including the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. An expert from the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics Foundation also believes the findings may be misleading to consumers. Shantia Hudson reports.
Recent news headlines about the possible cancer risk from using the common artificial sweetener aspartame might have alarmed people who eat and drink products that contain it. Now other organizations are looking more closely at those findings. The International Agency for Research on Cancer and a World Health Organization expert committee have labeled aspartame a possible carcinogenic. However, Hope Warshaw with the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics Foundation believes the report may be misleading to consumers and wants to call attention to what the research didn't say.
A WHO body made no change to the what's known as the acceptable daily intake, and they did this because they felt there was no new research and there was insufficient evidence to make a change.
Based on a review of several studies by the two separate committees, she says they found limited evidence suggesting a potential link between aspartame and liver cancer. In its own statement, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration also disagrees with the conclusion. It says the WHO labeling aspartame as a possible carcinogenic doesn't mean it is actually linked to cancer and is based on what the agency calls limited research. Warshaw says she is leaning on the science, and as a dietitian, she feels the sweetener is still a reliable tool and alternative.
I still recommend, if people so choose, to use aspartame and products that it is used in to achieve their nutrition goals and quench their sweet tooth.
The FDA noted that it will continue to monitor the latest science available on sweeteners. Warshaw underscores the most important thing a consumer can do is look to trusted evidence when making decisions. For North Carolina News Service, I'm Shantia Hudson.
A new Hollywood movie about a man who changed the course of history comes out today, reviving painful memories for many New Mexicans. Oppenheimer is about J. Robert Oppenheimer, a physicist and director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory during World War II. He is considered the father of the atomic bomb, which was first tested in southern New Mexico in July 1945. Many believe bomb fallout from the test is to blame for their family's history with cancer. Roz Brown has more.
This summer's Oppenheimer movie will shine a light on development of the first nuclear weapons, but for many in southern New Mexico, it's another reminder of the federal government's failure to recognize negative health effects their families have endured for generations. J. Robert Oppenheimer, a physicist and director of New Mexico's Los Alamos Laboratory during World War II, led the research and development of the first nuclear weapons tested in the southern part of the state. Tina Cordova, who founded the Tularosa Basin Downwinders Consortium, says residents were unknowingly exposed to radiation from fallout, resulting in illness, emotional and financial distress, and death.
The Manhattan Project and the Trinity bomb changed New Mexico forever. Instantaneously, we became basically a sacrifice zone, and the people of New Mexico have never been part of the narrative.
Cordova will participate in a panel discussion following a sold-out showing of the film in Santa Fe this weekend, along with Charles Oppenheimer, grandson of J. Robert Oppenheimer. Cordova says she's lost count of the number of relatives in New Mexico who have died from cancer, many within 10 years of the nuclear bomb testing.
In my own family, I'm the fourth generation to have cancer since 1945. And now I have a 23-year-old niece who's the fifth generation. And my family's not unique. It's the story we hear all across the southern part of New Mexico, where people lived as close as 12 miles to the test site.
Cordova has spent the past 18 years trying to get areas of New Mexico included in the Federal Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, which provides money to people who were harmed, either from uranium mining or the atomic tests. The act currently only offers compensation to downwinders who live in Arizona, Nevada, and Utah.
There was an admission of guilt on the part of the government when they established the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, but it didn't go far enough, including New Mexico. There's a lot of the American West that received regular fallout from those tests.
This is Roz Brown, New Mexico News Connection.
A Puerto Rican town avoided blackouts in key buildings during Hurricane Fiona thanks to a solar microgrid. Dr. Anthony Lizowicz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowicz, and this is Climate Connections. Last year, Hurricane Fiona hit Puerto Rico, knocking out power across the island. But in the mountain town of Castanier, the lights stayed on at a community center and several local businesses.
Everybody loses power, but the folks over in Castanier never lost power. Also, other residents of that local region were able to come into that business sector and drawing energy and electricity for basic necessities.
Carlos Alberto Velasquez Lopez is with the Puerto Rican Solar Business Accelerator, a program led by the Interstate Renewable Energy Council. He says Castanier had power thanks to a solar microgrid that his group helped install last year. It includes solar panels and battery storage that can operate independently of the island's electricity grid in an emergency. Velasquez Lopez says the need for the microgrid became clear when Hurricane Maria hit in 2017. It took more than 2 months for power to be restored to much of the island after the storm, In Castanier, the lights did not come back on for more than 6 months.
To me, that was unacceptable.
So the microgrid now offers residents more stability, even as climate change brings more extreme storms. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 21st, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Grant Button. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Laura Miller. Special thanks to Roz Brown, Alex Gonzalez, Tremel Gomes, Shantaya Hudson, Antonia Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The Director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned for Counterspin and have a great weekend.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, if corporate news media